Hello everybody, welcome to the Kill Germ podcast. This is part two of our interview with Rob Simpson. You can find the previous part on last week's podcast. Stay tuned for your plus points code towards the end of the episode.
Yeah, so if we go back to the space treatment, you would the first thing that you would do is calculate what is the volume of area that I'm treating.
Right.
So what is the width of the roof space? What is the length of the roof space? What is the height of the roof space? If that roof space is square, then you multiply those three dimensions together, you get the volume. If that was usually the case, certainly if you're dealing residential, is it's a pitched roof. So it's you work out the width, you work out the length, then you multiply those two together, and then you multiply it by half the height. Because you've got the sort of triangle shape as opposed to a squared off shape. And that will give you your total volume that you're treating. You can then use whatever solution that you've decided on to treat that volume. Now, one of the things that people who don't come across these very often have a tendency to do is, they may not have a fogging machine, they may not have a ULV machine, so what they will use is an aerosol or a smoke bomb, something like those. Smoke bombs aren't quite as popular as they used to. When I started out, smoke bombs were used all the time. You light effectively a little firework in the loft and it fills the whole thing with an insecticidal smoke. It also comes out all the edges of the roof space, and any passers-by think that the house is burning down and they phone up the fire brigade. So whenever you are using a smoke bomb, always let the fire brigade know what is happening. Otherwise, you're going to be sat outside that house explaining yourself to some very disgruntled fireman. And yeah, I have done that, and it's embarrassing. So what you've got to do is look at that method. So whether it be a smoke bomb, do you need a small one? Do you need a big one? Do you need two small ones as opposed to a big one? The aerosol. An aerosol will, so say something like a one shot, will treat 300 cubic meters. But if you've only got 80 cubic meters, you set off one of those, you're effectively overdosing. Which can be interesting as far as sort of cost regulations go. And that's why easily the best method is using a ULV. Yeah, if you use an ultra-low volume fogging solution, you're using a minimal amount of insecticide and you can be as accurate as possible and just work out your timings on your volume and set that off. And you, with some roof spaces, you literally might have your machine on for 5 seconds. As I said, we're using literally milliliters, you know, 5 or 6 milliliters of fluid. Which, if that's going to do the job with a minimal amount of insecticide, this is great for you, great for your customer, and great for the environment, because you're not just pumping insecticide willy-nilly.
And what are the kind of rules and regs are there for insecticide for cluster flies?
In any of the rules and regulations of insecticidal use are for insecticidal use rather than for cluster flies.
Okay.
So any of the rules and regulations that you're dealing with are exactly the same as they are for any other species. It is complying with all your cost regulations, complying with all the label, making sure that you've done your cost assessment from the label and the safety data sheet. If you're using a professional product, which most of the people listening to this, I would imagine, would be using a professional product as a professional. Have you got all the right qualifications and things like that? Are you experienced in using it? And then you've got to assess that site specifically. Again, so from an environmental point of view, are there bats or other non-target species that are present, then it's safe to do it. And if there aren't, which product would I use? Do I use something water based? Do I use something oil based or kerosene based? And then that might take into account: are there any sources of ignition in there? Has somebody got a boiler hiding at the back of the roof space? Because if you've got a boiler in there with a source of ignition, it's got a little pilot light on it. You don't want to be pumping that full of a kerosene-based insecticide. You definitely want to go with a water-based one.
And is there any DIY things that people can do who maybe aren't licensed pest controllers?
They should call a pest controller.
Okay.
Yes.
It's a good answer.
There aren't many things out there that I know of that are particularly good at a space treatment. So if you think of the aerosols that you could pop down to B&Q and get a tin of Raid, for example, or I'm sure other suitable products are available. They are to treat a surface for the most part. The direction that spray comes out, you press the button, you have to hold on to the button, it sprays out the same way that you do with it. You're treating your armpits when you're using your deodorant. Don't get your deodorant and your Raid mixed up. They will stick somewhat. That's not really a suitable solution to be treating a roof space, because you literally would have to stand there and just keep spraying around. Mm-hmm. Then the next bit that you have is you're now working in the roof space. You don't know what you're doing, and you're waving chemicals around. The average homeowner probably isn't wearing the right sort of PPE to be doing that, because this home use stuff is designed to just be sprayed on a surface and arms length and be used in small amounts. You start waving that around, you're breathing it in. You start waving it around and breathing it in, and you're stood next to a loft hatch or on the joists of a roof space. It's just screaming, I'm going to breathe some in, I'll start coughing, my attention goes onto the spray, it goes away from the loft hatch, it goes away from the joist, and you end up falling through a ceiling. So my advice in those cases, if you don't know what you're doing, just go and get someone who does.
Yeah.
There are pest controllers out there that do this all day, every day. They're very experienced. They know their stuff. And that they'll do a far safer and a far more effective job.
Is pest control covered under house insurance?
Depends very much on the house insurance. I've seen lots of people try to fight that corner with their home insurers. I have seen some people win. I have seen most people lose. Also, is pest control covered under your tenancy agreements for the people that are in rented? I was in rented a few years ago. I very definitely said in there that, the management of vermin is your responsibility of the tenant, not the landlord's responsibility. But that may be very different if you're in social housing or something along those lines.
So other than insecticides, is there any other things that you could use to get rid of pest flies?
Yeah, so quite as I said before, there is the specific fly killers do get used quite a lot, particularly in larger, probably more in the commercial sector. So if you think of office blocks or factories or commercial buildings like that, that may have plant rooms on the top, but they get affected just like the roof spaces did. You can put a fly killer in there, but if it is big numbers, which it very often is with cluster flies, it needs to be a specialist cluster fly unit that can deal with that amount of numbers.
Right.
The place with the hermetically sealed labs had a whole series of cluster fly units, actually from Gilju, or Pest West, I should say, in the days before I worked it. But they would just fill up huge buckets.
Right.
Dip bags and things like that were below them. When you get a big cluster fly problem, the numbers of insects are quite phenomenal.
So do the control method vary based on the season?
Yeah. So it very much depends. I mean, we are talking, when we say we treat in autumn and then perhaps in spring, and that is very much a generalization. This is, these are the seasons when they are at their most active. This is when they are the biggest problem. I've actually got a customer with some residential sort of holiday homes in the middle of nowhere. and they get affected, and they have to do treatments in between individual the sort of tenancies. So as once the holiday leg makers leave, they come in and they do a treatment, which allows the next one, so they keep the numbers down. They do get hit with huge numbers. That's a very specific thing to them. And then in that scenario, they've got to be very careful with things like resistance. So they have a whole mixture of stuff that they use. And then we've talked about the sort of the space treatments. But then as you come down through the house, you can quite effectively turn windows into fly killers. There is no fly killer out there whatsoever that is going to take on the sun for the amount of UV that it pumps out. Windows can be very effective at attracting flies. You can, if it is safe to do so, treat those windows with a residual insecticide. You've got to look for smear and things like that, so you don't actually damage the windows. And then they'll go to the window, and then they'll just drop out dead. So at least they're not flying around. You still have all the dead insects on the window ledge. Another thing that is very useful, particularly if you've got an older timber-framed window, there's all sorts of cracks around those things. So where that window opens, very often you will just find it lined with cluster flies, quite often dead and crusty. But they'll go into the gaps where the window opens and closes. Coincidentally, the other clustering, overwintering species, ladybirds, they're very often there as well. And what you can do there is quite effectively get a really good residual insecticide, usually something microencapsulated, and then treat on the inside of those window frames, and then obviously shut those back again. And that just becomes a killing ground for the insects as they're coming in. It protects.
So what is the cost associated with cluster fly pest control to do a residential property?
It really depends on the residential property. If you're doing a space treatment in a 3-bedroom semi or something like that, maybe a few window treatments, and you've got to get to sign, you've got to work out what's happening, you've got to assess everything, you've got to check for your bats and make sure that all of that side of the work is done. I'm a great advocate for making sure you get paid for that work. Sometimes people just price up the time for the treatment from getting stuff out of the vat to doing it. You can't do the treatment without the proper assessment, so you need to be paid for that time for doing the proper assessments. But if it's nice and simple and there's nothing in the way, it's relatively small, you can be in and out in an hour. If you've already been to sites and you know exactly what you're walking into, then you can be in and out in half an hour. But you might also be, your residential place might be, I don't know, an 18-bedroom mansion in the middle of nowhere. These are the sorts of places that get hit very hard with cluster flies. You could be there a day at something like that, crawling around all sorts of different roof spaces to treat those. So it's very much property dependent, rather than the pest dependent. Like with any treatment that we do, get there, assess it, see how long it was going to take, how much stuff is going to be required to do it. If you, as the pest controller, you have your rate at which you charge, just multiply that by the amount of time that it's going to take.
And what are the signs of a successful pest control operation?
Reduced or little numbers of cluster flies is the simple answer. And most importantly, a happy client. If you do any form of treatment that is safe and effective, you haven't broken any laws, you haven't hurt anybody, and your client is happy, this is a successful treatment. But you are just controlling numbers.
Yeah.
And you're controlling numbers in a way that very often with cluster flies, you're not waving your magic wand. You're not going in there and saying, right, I shall sort this out and you will never have a fly problem again. Usually, again, it is a generalization, they will have that fly problem over and over and over again. They have the fly problem because of the location that the property is in. Very often, they have chosen that location because of the lovely fields and woodland and things like that are around them. This is a nice place to be. Well, with those fields and woodlands come certain bits of nature that want to climb into your roof space and then do back things on your window ledges.
Okay, so what you're saying is there's no kind of long-term prevention. It's a year-on-year job fairly often.
Yeah, well, you can control the numbers.
Right.
By doing either regular treatments, sometimes those fly killers can do a really good job just constantly mopping them up.
Yeah.
But you'll still need to go back and service those fly killers. Those boxes that are underneath them, those bags that I was talking about, someone's got to go there and take all of that away and replace it with an empty one. Someone's got to change the bulbs on those fly killers. Even if you end up with an LED cluster fly unit, which I don't know that there's a specialist one out there right now, but if you did, you'd still need to go and service that. So it's more of an ongoing thing with cluster flies. Unless that customer is really lucky, you do want treatment and they don't. You know, you treat it, but then they don't come back again.
Yeah.
I have found that not to be impossible, but a bit of a rarity.
Right. What should I be aware of regarding the environmental impact of cluster fly control methods?
Well, you've got your use of chemicals and the effects of those chemicals. You've got all your cost regulations that you need to abide by. That's why I like the ULV stuff, because you are literally using the smallest amount of chemicals possible.
Yeah.
But again, the biggest environment, because you're treating an enclosed environment with cluster flies. So whatever system that you're using, you have a degree of control about to that space, because that is an enclosed space. It has walls, it has a roof. You're not treating the outside of a building to treat the cluster fly. So environmentally, you would hope that your chemical as such is controlled that way. But environmentally, you may have other species that are in that area, yeah, particularly bats.
Right.
Now I've said that, there are certain types of cluster fly, and I'm thinking yellow swarming fly in particular, where they can, instead of clustering inside a building, they will cluster on the outside of a building. And there's been quite a few episodes of, say, something like a tower block, a 20-story tower block, and it's been painted white, and they all cluster together on the bright white south-facing wall of that building. And they're going there because it's just reflecting. It's warm. It's a nice place to be. It's usually reflecting a load of UV as well, which is bringing them in. I have seen people treat, you know, quite large parts of buildings with a residual insecticide. And if you are doing something like that, you need to take very close note as to what product you're using. Is it safe to do so? Is it authorized to do so? Because you are, in that scenario, you are bringing your insecticide into the world in general. And you know, physical control measures stopping non-target species getting to that insecticide.
And what kind of insecticide is used? What kind of brands? What kind of products?
Well, as with all insecticides these days, it's a variant of the same thing, which is sort of pyrethroids, synthetic pyrethroids, or natural pyrethrins. certainly if you were trying to do something outside, you'd probably be looking at the natural pyrethrins as being your most environmentally friendly option, if friendly is the right word. But then the products that you would use inside, well, you're certainly not spraying with a benzene comb anymore, which people used to do. So there you will be looking at some of the fogging solutions, all of which tend to be the pyrethroids. So your tetramethrins, cypermethrins, permethrins, all of these sorts of products.
So what are the pros and cons of using chemical insecticides for cluster fly control?
Well, pros and cons of insecticides use. Pros is it's fast. If you're fogging an area, particularly something that's got a tetramethrin in it, it's incredibly quick. And it gets control of the situation very quickly for your client. The cons of using that insecticide are the safety of its use, and whether or not it can be used in relation to, say, the bats that we talked about before, or whether or not it is enclosed enough to be used in such a way. The problem comes if you do have cluster flies and you do have bats. In this scenario, whilst you have bats, you're having cluster flies. A bat-friendly solution that gets rid of cluster flies and the old cluster busters, bless them, were the best methods for that. But you wouldn't be able to do that space treatment at all if you have bats in there. So what you would end up doing is just doing those treatments further down the property. So those window treatments that we spoke about. You'd just be limited to those because presumably they don't have bats in their living rooms or bedrooms.
So who do you call if you have bats in your property then?
Bat Conservation Trust. Oh. There's lots of stuff online. There's people in all parts of the country that will set you in the right direction, and there will be a bat specialist near you somewhere. That bat specialist will probably judge your client a small fortune to come out and assess the bats.
So what are some examples of different types of cluster flies?
So, yeah, if we sort of list the common species, like we said, Plinia rubis is the usual one that people come across. One that looks similar-ish, another sort of house fly-y looking fly, is the autumn fly, or some people call it a face fly, I believe. I've always known it as the autumn fly. Those green cluster flies, they are quite fantastic looking things. I believe there's also a blue cluster fly as well. And then you've got your yellow swarming fly. Most of my experience in pest control is in the northwest of England, and we don't tend to get too many problems here with yellow swarming fly. But I know that my customers, certainly over on the east a little bit, but particularly further south, get hit with the yellow swarming fly quite a bit.
So are they prevalent?
I would say the most common cluster fly, as in the number of customers that will phone you with a cluster fly problem, would certainly be Plinia rubis. I wouldn't like to say which is the most common cluster fly, as in number of flies, because certainly when yellow swarming flies get hold, they have huge clusters or swarms or whatever you would like to collectively now and put them together. Their numbers can't be incredibly high.
Okay. And do they transmit diseases?
Not really, no.
Okay.
No, they're relatively safe in that respect. They're more of a nuisance pest than a public health pest.
Okay.
I I think it would be fair to say that although they don't tend to, they certainly have the ability to. Yep. You know, they are still a fly. They are still moving around. You can have all sorts of bacteria in particular on them. And there's plenty of studies out there that have, you know, isolated the bacteria that are on the flies. But because they don't do that transfer in quite the same way that, say, a housefly is, they're not quite the public health pest that, say, a housefly is.
Okay.
You know, that's not to say that they don't carry diseases. I don't want anyone to think, okay, they are, you know, somehow a clean fly. They're not. You know, you've got all sorts of Bacillus species on there. You've got all sorts of Staphylococcus and all your usual suspects of flies, are very. You know, they can, when isolated and yet spread, they can cause some very nasty diseases. It's just the way in which they operate is not going to spread it to humans in quite the same way that houseflies definitely will.
Because they're not interested in human food.
Yeah, it's that's not their modus operandi. They're not moving from food to waste, to food to waste, to food to waste. It's they will pick things up as they're moving along. Yeah. I'm just looking at a study of bacteria isolated from Polinia rudis. Yeah. So. Yeah, so if we there was a study that was done on at a German hospital in 1997 into the diseases carried by Polinia rudis, and the first thing that they noted is that the flies were not seen crowding on organic litter or general waste. They weren't crowding around medical waste. They weren't crowding around sort of bodies of humans and stuff like that. They were just looking at those windows and the nooks and crannies and doing the whole cluster fly thing. That said, when they then take those away and they test them for everything, you have got your Bacillus species, your Eumenia species, all sorts of different species of bacteria, Staphylococcus, Pseudomonas, Cyanobacterium. And when you look at those lists of what diseases they can spread, it can be things like meningitis, you know, endocarditis, all of which are, you know, big red flags to a pest controller of all of these terrible diseases that are being spread. It's just the likelihood of doing it. They have the possibility of doing it, but the likelihood of doing it is considerably less than other species of flies.
Thank you to Rob Simpson for joining us today. For more information, visit kiljim.com. Your plus points code today is Cluster. That's Charlie, Limo, Uniform, Sierra, Tango, Echo, Romeo. That's Cluster. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon.